This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
So I would like to just say welcome to this wonderful crowd for this program. We put this program on as we approach Yom Yerushalayim, and we thought it was highly appropriate. So I'd like to welcome everybody to Pardes. My name is Alex Israel, and I run the community education program here. I'd also like to draw your attention to on the seats, where on every other seat, there is our program for Tikkun Leil Shavuot, our Shavuot program. So I just urge you to all take a look. We really have a wonderful array of speeches and shiurim for the night of Shavuot. So we'll be really excited to see you all back in a few weeks' time for Tikkun Leil Shavuot. So just please, you're welcome to take the information with you, and we'll see you back then. Okay, and without further ado, welcome to Yossi Klein HaLevi. And there is a program on the radio, on Gali Tzahal, where whenever it's actually, if I'm not mistaken, the economic program, and they begin every interview by requesting the guests to present a short Teudat Zehut, a who are you, who you are, some key life landmarks, some achievements, some interests. So who are you, Yossi Klein HaLevi?
So good evening, everybody. I would have to begin as I think in a very Jewish way. I have to begin with my parents, specifically my father, who was a survivor from Hungary. And my father survived by escaping to the forest and lived in a hole with two friends. And I describe being raised with his stories. When I was young, my father spoke constantly about his experiences in the war. And those of you who know survivor families will appreciate that that's actually a very rare experience, because most survivors that I knew did not speak to their children about the experience. I think it had something to do with the fact that my father wasn't in a camp. And so I really grew up very much, I'd say, obsessed when I was younger with this hole. And when I read The Hobbit in high school, The Hobbit, of course, opens up with there was a hobbit who lived in a hole. And I thought, if I ever write about my father's experience, I'm going to steal that line from The Hobbit. And my first book is about growing up as the child of a survivor and Brooklyn in the 60s and early 70s, the Soviet Jewry movement, the JDL, Meir Kahana. So that's part of my background. And in that book, my first line was, "My father lived in a hole," and that, of course, comes from Tolkien. So I think that's an interesting way of describing what my upbringing was like, growing up in Borough Park in the 1960s, obsessed with the Shoah, which happened 20 years earlier. I mean, it's amazing to think we're now 70 years afterwards, and it was so raw that there were almost no films. I remember there was one film, Night and Fog. Some of you may remember. There were no films about the Shoah. There were hardly any books. There was Elie Wiesel and almost no one else. And so I grew up determined to write about this story that nobody seemed to be writing about, and to respond to it as an activist, as a teenager in the Soviet Jewry movement, in the JDL, after graduating to the JDL, and then spending a good part of my life after that withdrawing from Meir Kahana and the activism of rage and the us versus them mentality with which I had grown up, and moving to Israel with my girlfriend, who has been my wife for the last 34 years, and moving here in 1982, and three kids, and Israel was really essential for, I would say, freeing me from the traumas of my childhood. Now, one can never be entirely free from the traumas of childhood, but in the sense of presenting a Jewish reality in which we were not victims. I was drafted into the army during the First Intifada and served in Gaza refugee camps, and that was a very important emotional experience for me to realize that that Jewish reality was different, had really changed, and that and I thought a lot about this at the time, that the gap in the kinds of issues that my generation has to deal with compared to my father's generation really in some sense should have been measured by centuries. There should have been centuries separating the experience of growing up in America, coming to Israel, growing up in the most privileged Jewish community in history, coming to a sovereign Jewish state, serving in the Israeli army with complicated moral issues. For my father, there were no complicated issues. It was all very black and white. Jewish reality could not have been more clear. And so a measure of how my biography is different from my father's is in how much more complicated the questions that we face today are than my father.
Thank you very much. Well, if we're talking about coming to Israel, the book that you've written, Like Dreamers, which is quite the magnum opus. You said, you told me it took 11 years to write, and I can fully understand that. The amount of research which went into it is quite stupendous. Well, it certainly takes off from the reunification of Yerushalayim and the capture of the Kotel. And it really covers the breadth and depth of 40 years of Israeli history ever since 1967. A remarkable work of scholarship. I've really been curious. It's a huge project. What stimulated you to embark on this enormous project? What was your objective? What were you trying to achieve by writing the book? Maybe I'll add, do you think you achieved it?
Well, if I knew what I was getting into when I started this project, I would have never done it. I told my wife this was going to be an easy one. I said, I'm going to interview a few paratroopers. I just want to be sure that we don't lose the stories of, I really wanted to know about June 7th, 1967. I wanted to know what happened the day the paratroopers reached the wall. There were a few famous stories which had become kind of cliches, but I really wanted to know what happened to, just ordinary paratroopers, although that's kind of a contradiction in terms for those years. I really wanted to know what happened at the wall. And that's pretty much what I thought the book would be about, their experiences then, and then tell something about their lives today. I did not imagine writing a book that traces the lives of seven emblematic men, through 40 years. And I researched, I interviewed, it took me about 2 years, and according to my book contract, I was supposed to submit a manuscript after 2 years. And after 2 years, I didn't have a word written. I had lots of great stories that I had heard from people, but there was no coherent book, and I didn't know what this was about. And I told my editor, I said, look, I'm really sorry this happens. And it happens a fair bit in publishing. And it's just happened to me, and I just don't see a book here. And she said, well, let's think about, you know, make a list of the people you've interviewed and see if there's a pattern and see if you can tell something of the story of Israel through a few of these characters. So I made a list, and what emerged was a pattern. And there were two groups that really were ideological camps within the paratroopers of those years. The secular kibbutzniks, who were by far the most dominant in the paratroopers. And then there was a smaller, uh, uh, but very hungry group. And by hungry, I mean that they looked at the secular kibbutzniks and they wanted to be them. And these were the religious Zionists. And this is not the religious Zionism that we know today. This is not the self-confident, religious Zionism of Bennett, and it's a new generation. This was a very self-conscious generation that saw the secularists as leading Zionism and wanted their place in that role. And I said, that's a really interesting story. And the more I looked into it, it wasn't only religious Zionists, it was some of the most important leaders of the settlement movement, as it turns out, were part of the paratroopers in Jerusalem. And then an argument about Israeli history began to coalesce for me, which is that 1967, we all know that 1967 was a kind of changing of the guard. But I had never read a certainly not a personal way of telling that story, but even a convincing argument for what actually happened. And to realize that the story of a group of men who experienced the most utopian moment, the most messianic moment in Israel's history, June 7th, 1967, together at the wall. And one part of this group represents a secular form of messianism, the kibbutz movement, which is on its way to losing its vitality and losing its self-confidence, its ideological self-confidence. And another group of messianic Zionists, religious Zionists, who are just waiting in the wings to prove their mettle, to prove that they are worthy too of leading the country, and realizing that there was a changing of the guard here, even though nobody realized it at the time, because the secular kibbutzniks were the officers' corps. They're the ones who led the victory in 1967, and it was a labor government. That this was the culmination of labor's claim to legitimacy, to leading the country, June 1967. And so you have this group that's waiting in the wings. So that's not the story that I thought I was going to tell when I started this book. But after 2 years of failure, and then being given a second chance and a third and fourth chance by my editor, I kept breaking the deadlines, and she really was, you could not ask for a more accommodating editor than someone who will actually give you 11 years. And then finally, into the 11th year of the book, Claire Wachtel, my editor, who also grew up in Borough Park, interestingly enough, there's a little Borough Park mafia in publishing. That's about the extent of it, but, and so Claire sends me a note saying, it's basically now or never. I can't hold on anymore. And I was very resentful, of course. You know, why are you rushing me? I really felt that, you know, I have another 2 years of work and I can do it properly. And she said, no, this is it. It has to be now. So I essentially rushed the manuscript through. And that's what happened. Now you're asking what I set out to achieve. The story that I finally realized I wanted to tell. And I also should say that for many years of this process, it was an awful writing experience. There was nothing joyful about this. And one of the reasons why it took so long is because for many years, I didn't hear the voice of the book. And a writer has to hear the voice of a book. Every book has a particular voice. A reader may not be conscious of what that voice is, but you know, on some level, every reader knows what the voice of a particular book that you're reading is. And I heard no voice here. The book was mute, and it was driving me mad. And all I heard was the left arguments, the right arguments, okay, the kibbutzniks, the settlers, back and forth. And one morning I woke up, and it was literally so. I suddenly heard the voice of the book. And the voice of the book was this argument. It was Israel arguing with itself. And it was the soul of Israel tearing itself apart over our impossible dilemmas. And as soon as I realized that, I understood that I could own this book, because that was actually my voice. That was my Israeli voice, where left and right have been arguing inside of me since I made Aliyah at the beginning of the First Lebanon War in August 1982, a few weeks before the Sabra and Shatila massacre. That was the Israel that I moved to. And so I've been conflicted ever since between left and right. And my voting patterns have reflected that. I am always voting against myself from the previous election, trying to undo the mistake that I made. So, and finally I realized that I'm not a leftist and I'm not a rightist, I'm a centrist. And that's what an Israeli centrist is. It's left and right arguing. It's internalizing the left-right split. So that was the book that I wanted to write. And the story that, well, I would say that the narrative device of the book is the purpose of the book. Those of you who have read it will know that the book tells, it goes back and forth between the characters, and you will often experience the same historical moment through very different, even opposing, sensibilities. And that was really so that's the style of the book. And it's very, I tried as much as possible to step back and to try to be inside the heads of these men and let the reader experience the very disorienting, sense of going through the same historical events from opposing perspectives. So that was the device, the literary device of the book. And it's also the purpose of the book, which is to disorient the reader so that whatever side you're on, you are forced to experience something of the logic and the emotions of the opposite camp, and to force you out of your ideological comfort zone and to create an experience of what I would say is Klal Yisrael. Because we are the sum total of our contradictions.
Okay, wow.
That's a good question.
as you said, the book tracks seven different people, seven people who were paratroopers at the time of the Shikhrur of the Kotel. And they really are so diverse in nature. Some are artists, musicians. Some, as you said, are leaders of the settler movement. One of them decided to deconstruct sort of the nationalist economy and try to push capitalism here in the state of Israel.
The socialist economy.
Mm-hmm. And I'm really interested to know, I know it might not be a fair question, but that's my job. Which, can you pick two characters you were particularly attracted to? And tell us why you were particularly attracted to those, some that you maybe, you know, really found heroic in some way or inspirational.
I mean, the truth is that on a certain level, I am deeply attracted to all of them, including one or two characters, one in particular, who, from an ideological point of view, is anathema to me. One of the characters who became fervently anti-Zionist went to Syria in 1972. This was a very famous Israeli story. And the Yom Kippur War kind of wiped it out of the national memory. But Israel was traumatized in 1972 by this story. A paratrooper, a kibbutznik, who went to Syria and tried to start an anti-Zionist terror underground, and spent 15 or 12 years in an Israeli prison. And when I found out that he was one of the paratroopers at the wall, I felt it just doesn't get any better than that. As a writer, when you're looking for stories, I mean, it's kind of an ultimate story. And the other paratroopers were very angry at me when I put him in the book. He wasn't one of us. I said, well, he certainly was one of you, in June 67. And, I said, look, you know, I'm not writing the, and then they would say, well, he wasn't important. He wasn't a hero. He didn't do anything in the paratroopers. I said, look, I'm not writing the history of Brigade 55. What I'm trying to do is really tell a story about Israel, and what happened to us as a result of the 67 war. And he, Udi Adiv, was one of the options that opened up 67. And we're seeing that today very clearly. Udi Adiv was a kind of precursor of the post-Zionism and anti-Zionism of a part of the Israeli elite. You can read it on the pages of Haaretz every day. And in 1972, that was a scandal, but a very prescient moment. So anyway, that's a kind of a general answer, is that, I really love each of these characters, including him. And what I told him the first day that we met, I said to him that our ideological positions are diametrically opposite. But I will treat you fairly, and I believe that I did. I will treat you fairly in the book because you and I both have extremist personalities. And I told him that when he was in Syria in 1972, I was with Meir Kahana and the JDL. And in fact, the chapter that I call, in this book, the chapter that where I describe Udi Adiv's trip to Syria, is called Across the Border or Crossing the Border. And that's the same name that I gave to a chapter in my autobiography, my Memoirs of a Jewish Extremist, which was my first book, where I wrote about a demonstration that a group of us did in Moscow in 1973. So that was a little bit of a wink when I linked Udi to the JDL. So I really found I found common ground with each one of these men. My two favorite characters, if I have to choose, one is Arik Achmon. Arik Achmon is the ultimate Sabra, the ultimate hero, born raised in Kibbutz Givat Brenner. He was the chief intelligence officer of the paratroopers in 1967. He and Mota Gur were the first soldiers on the Temple Mount. He took me up to the Temple Mount while I was researching the book and gave me a kind of a step-by-step recounting of what had happened when they reached the Temple Mount. And then he says, come, I want to show you something. And he takes me to the doorway, the entranceway of the Dome of the Rock, and there are bullet holes there. And he says, these are from my Uzi. He said, I shot open the lock, and I opened the door to the Dome of the Rock. So Arik is the ultimate Zionist hero. He was the senior commander who led the paratroopers across the Suez Canal in 1973. And when I started the book, just to give you an idea of how little I knew about these stories, I didn't know that the same unit that had reached the wall in 1967, crossed the canal in 1973, and basically won the Yom Kippur War, at least on the Egyptian front. And it was the guys from the wall. And it was Arik who led the crossing. He was the senior officer. He was the guy who planned the crossing. So, and then he goes on to an extraordinary career, which has been forgotten in Israel, and I hope, God willing, when the English translation comes out next year, that Arik will regain the Hebrew, that Arik will regain his place here. Arik was the first privatizer in the state of Israel. He privatized Arkia, the airline. He was the CEO of Arkia, and he fought the Histadrut and actually, through the force of his will, brought about the economic revolution that, from my point of view, freed us from a terrible statist economy. And so Arik is my first hero.
And you also mention in the book the way that he established an organization for orphans for families.
Right. Arik created a prototype for how the army should deal with the families and particularly the children of fallen soldiers. And he created this infrastructure where paratroopers adopt families. And they started this group called Hachaverim Shel Abba, the Friends of Dad. And this really became a model for other units in the army. So in so many ways, I mean, he's become one of my closest friends. He just turned 83 yesterday. And, I tell him this half jokingly that his name should be as co-author on the book because he spent hundreds and hundreds of hours with me. Literally so. Making sure that I understood every detail of kibbutz life, of 67, of 73. And so he is, I'd say what I learned about Arik is what it takes to build a country. And it takes somebody who is not sentimental. He's one of the least sentimental people that I've ever met in my life. He's changing a little bit in old age. And he is really, and there are other people like him. And he, getting to know him, he's also married to the daughter of Yaakov Chazan. For those of you who know the name, Yaakov Chazan was the legendary leader of HaShomer HaTzair, the kibbutz movement, the youth movement, and really a founding father here. And so getting to know Arik was, for me as an American immigrant, was this extraordinary experience of really being kind of admitted into the Mayflower generation here. And that's and believe me, they know it. When I first went to see Arik, he said, "You can't do this book." I said, "Why not?" He said, "Because you're a yeled chutz." And a yeled chutz is not a flattering term. It comes from the kibbutz movement. In the old days, the kibbutzim used to adopt children who either were orphans or whose families couldn't raise them. And they always remained yaldei chutz on the kibbutz. And he said, "You're a yeled chutz. You'll never get this story." And I said, "Well, you know, you're right. I am a yeled chutz. But what you, Tzabarim, never understood about us yaldei chutz is that we were spies among you. And we were always watching the ways of the natives to try to understand where we fell. What is this society? And as a result of that, we yaldei chutz often know you better than you know yourselves." So that was... So he's my first hero, and we fight all the time. He's impossible, and I get impossible with him. And he, as I say, he's one of the people I love most in the world. And the second hero of the book is, for me, is Yoel Ben Nun, who was one of the founders of the settlement movement, became, over the years, the great heretic of the settlement movement, even though... he still believes passionately in the same ideals that animated him as a young man. He feels that if you weigh the wholeness of the land against the wholeness of the people come first. And the story that this book tells is really the evolution of Yoel Ben Nun, how he became the great iconoclast of the settlement movement, and paid an enormous price. He was one of the most beloved figures in the settlement movement and became widely despised or ignored. He still certainly has his place, but he lost a great deal and is to my mind, one of the heroic figures here. The book ends with Yoel Ben-Nun, and if you ever want to know the opinions of a journalist or a writer, see who they quote last in an article or a book, and that's always the giveaway. Who you give the last word to is who you're really giving the book to.
Well, we didn't plan this, but my very next question quotes exactly that last quote of the book. Because you do describe how complicated the Israeli story is. And as Yoel Ben-Nun says in the final pages of the book, he talks about how amazing it was and how clear things seemed when they stood there before the Kotel on that auspicious day. And then he says to the people around him, redemption is complicated. It's a process. Here in Yerushalayim, we celebrate Yom Yerushalayim, and it's celebrated as a day of the city's reunification and the day of the liberation of the Kotel HaMaravi, the Western Wall, and this really amazing historical event that you describe. And there's no doubt that these were seminal events for Yerushalayim and for Israel as a whole, changed history, but for Jewry around the world. And yet, at the same time, whereas in some communities Hallel is recited and it's seen as a religious day and a joyous day, even in Jerusalem and certainly outside Jerusalem, the day is hardly marked, barely gets a mention. People don't take the day off work, or it's not like Yom HaAtzmaut. Outside the religious Zionist community, if you don't turn on the radio, you won't even know it's Yom Yerushalayim. So I'm wondering why this is. Do people look back at that day in 1967 with regret? Has the story of the occupation or the stalled and intractable peace process made things so complicated we just can't celebrate even? Can't dance in the streets? Has that great triumph, that transformative moment, fallen flat? Or maybe our historical perspective is wrong. Maybe we need to get some historical perspective and regain that elation, regain that pristine moment. We have this dream, like dreamers, and has it fallen flat?
Well, I think that one of the misfortunes that have befallen this day, Yom Yerushalayim, which I think is one of the great days of Jewish history, is that much of the expression of how this day is celebrated is in an extreme nationalist form, which excludes a large part of the country. So, for example, you've got the parade, the dancing through Arab neighborhoods on Yom Yerushalayim, which, to my mind, is appalling. It's waving the flag in your face. And I think that and other expressions of how the day has come to be celebrated have really alienated many Israelis. You speak about the occupation, and I would just like to clarify, for me, I speak of the occupation as well, but I don't speak of occupying the land, because I don't believe that we are occupiers in any part of this land. I believe deeply that it is our land. There is another people there, and with a great deal of pain, I feel we have no choice but to try to reach an agreement. But that's very different from saying that I don't belong there, or that I'm an occupier in somebody else's land. I am not an occupier in Judea and Samaria, and for me it's Judea and Samaria. I am an occupier of another people. Here again, I have no apologies for that. I don't believe I have a choice. I believe we really tried to end the occupation, our occupation of another people. I think that we are a very strange occupier, in that we are the only occupier that I know of in history that fears that if we withdraw from territory, we won't simply be diminished, but risk, God forbid, being destroyed, risk not being able to protect ourselves from the pre-67 borders. So I think that we in the past have shown good faith. I don't think we're showing particularly good faith at the moment, but I think there were major milestones where we showed good faith, and on the other side, all we got was a wall of rejectionism. So I don't feel guilty, and I even again, even though I believe deeply that we need to try constantly to see whether there's a way of ending our occupation over another people. So in that sense, Alex, I think that the debilitating impact of 50 years of occupying another people has taken a great deal of the joy out of this day, and understandably so, for me as well. It hasn't taken the awe away, but it certainly has taken. I can't simply join the dancing circles and pretend that this is all just one great happy Jewish story. I know. I've experienced being an occupier. I've been in people's homes at 2 a.m. And again, I don't regret what I did, but I know that to simply turn this into an ecstatic messianic moment is to cheapen the experience that so many of us here have had as a consequence of June 67. So I'm looking for ways in which, as a religious Jew, in which to express my gratitude and awe for Yom Yerushalayim. But it's not within the framework of this nationalist messianic ecstasy.
Okay, so if we're talking about national messianic ecstasy, one of the amazing scenes that you describe on that day by the Kotel is the way that some of the religious Zionist soldiers, as they're celebrating at the Western Wall, the first thing they can think of doing is actually rushing their rabbi, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, and the Nazir in a jeep over to the Kotel. This is the most important. They're rabbis who almost predicted this event in their speeches in Merkaz HaRav. They sense this incredible high and really feel that the redemption is coming. And this becomes one of the major themes of your book. You describe the religious Zionist movement, rabbis like Rav Yoel Ben Nun, Hanan Porat, and their mentors, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook and Rav Amital of Yeshivat Har Etzion. And you depict an incredible process, as you mentioned, whereby, especially in your chapter about the Yom Kippur War, which I love that you called it not just the War of Atonement, but Atonement, that in the Yom Kippur War, Israeli society suddenly senses the failure of the labor-run leadership and the vacuous feeling of a loss of national confidence, and the young religious Zionists decide to fill that vacuum. And then you describe the process whereby there are moments in which, some quite frightening moments, of this, the messianic extremism of this camp, whether it's the Rabin assassination, whether it's the Baruch Goldstein massacre in Hebron, or the character of Yehuda Etzion, who you describe very vividly, and the Machteret Yehudit, the Jewish underground, which attempted to, or certainly didn't quite attempt, but had in its sights to blow up the Temple Mount. So just, this week, we heard a speech by Bugi Yaalon warning of extremist and dangerous forces that have taken over Israel and the Likud movement, and that are destabilizing our home and threatening to harm its inhabitants. And you've mentioned, I was going to say you've written, but you've already mentioned your youth close to somebody who was banned from Knesset because of his racist views, Meir Kahana. So I'm wondering, you know, you studied this movement called the Religious Zionist Movement, the Settler Movement. Is it an asset to Israeli society, or is it a menace to Israeli society? What does religious Zionism have to do to curb its extreme elements? Do you see personalities? You mentioned that Rav Yoel Ben Nun has been vilified within his community, and he is one of the moderates who decided to put the integrity of the people of Israel before the whole people of Israel, before the whole land of Israel. Are there any, if he's been vilified, are there any other moderates in that camp who can lead that process?
Well, before I answer the, those are very, very powerful questions, let me just give a little bit of a context for it. The story that's told here is really, it's called like Dreamers because it's really about it's a way of understanding the history of Israel through our messianic dreams. And that there were these two camps, the camp of the secular socialist messianists, utopians, who essentially represented Israel in the world for many decades. The kibbutz was the symbol of Israel. When I was moving to Israel, I mentioned to someone, not a non-Jewish man, that I was moving to Israel. He said, "Oh, you're going to a kibbutz." So, you know, that was really the symbol of Israel. Today, the symbol of Israel in the world is more or less the settlement. So, which represents another messianic version. So the story really is about the clash of messianic dreams happening among a group of men who together experienced the peak messianic moment in Israel's history. So that's really what this story is about. And one of the reasons that attracted me to this story is because I am a messianist. I believe that this is a messianic moment in Jewish history. I would say literally, I think there's as a religious person who believes that history has a script, and there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to, I mean, that's, as a writer, I think I really appreciate the Judaic sensibility of history. History is a story. And the end of the story is redemption, is the revelation of the reality of God. And I believe that this moment is an opening. I'm not a determinist. You know, some of Gush Emunim, the settlement movement, said absolutely it has to be, and all we have to do is settle the land, and almost measuring through kilometers how much redemption is required. So I'm much more skeptical than that, but I'm very much in the camp of Yoel Ben Nun, who made a very powerful case to me about what happened in 1967. And you touched on Rav Tzvi Yehuda's speech. For me, it was one of the most powerful moments in the book, was coming across the text of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook's speech two or three weeks before the Six-Day War, before anybody knew that there was going to be a war, and suddenly crying out, "Where is our Shechem? Where is our Hebron?" This has become a legend in the religious Zionist world. And I felt reading it that I was in the presence of prophecy, that there was a kind of a outbreak of prophecy here. Literally, figuratively, I don't know what to say, but I certainly can't dismiss those religious Zionists who in the summer of 67, knowing Rav Tzvi Yehuda's speech, and going through that experience, came to the conclusion that this is the moment. It has to be the moment. So I take the messianic anticipation seriously. The quickening of anticipation after 67 is something that I very much identify with, even though, as I say, I'm more wary, certainly of the aggressive nationalist forms that messianism has taken. nevertheless, I remain very much open to that possibility that something is happening in this story. So, fast forwarding then to your questions, Alex, about religious Zionism. So my first answer is, before I try to address the question of is religious Zionism an asset or a danger, my first response is that I understand and to some extent shared the transformation of religious Zionism from one of the most moderate bourgeois movements within Zionism to the most revolutionary. And that's a transformation that begins in 67, but really takes off in 1973 with the collapse of the labor government and labor Zionism's credibility. That's the moment when religious Zionism, a younger generation of religious Zionism, says, now it's our turn. Even though I don't consider myself part of the religious Zionist camp, certainly not politically, I consider myself a religious person and I'm a Zionist, so I suppose that makes me a religious Zionist in some fashion. In terms of asset or danger, is religious Zionism today an asset? Was that the question? An asset or a danger? My answer is yes. And on the one hand, and this is a story I think most of us here know, on the one hand, the religious Zionist community has become an essential backbone of Israel's defense. And in large part, that is a gift to Israel that came as a result of the settlement movement. A lot of the kids who are emerging in the front rank of officers grew up in settlements. When you grow up in an ideological hothouse outside the cities, that's what happened with the kibbutz movement. The kibbutz movement produced generations of leaders of the army because they grew up in these rural, intensely ideological communities. Now, religious Zionism succeeded in creating a similar model, and the leaders of the settlement movement did so consciously. They modeled themselves after the kibbutz movement, at least in the early years. And it was thrilling for me to realize, you know, I think one of the exciting things for me in writing this book was starting to connect the dots of all of these bits of information that were floating in my head about Israel and suddenly seeing patterns. So the first settlement in September 1967, before Hebron, before Sebastia, which is already later in 75, the first settlement is Kfar Etzion, right? The orphans of Kfar Etzion returning to the site and reestablishing. And Kfar Etzion was, before 48, a kibbutz, and they reestablished it as a kibbutz. And it was thrilling for me to realize there's the missing link between the settlement movement, the messianic religious settlement movement, and the messianic kibbutz movement, Kfar Etzion. And of course the settlement movement eventually left the kibbutz model. But initially the ethos, the culture of the settlement movement was kibbutz. A fair number of young people who were among the founders of the settlement movement came from religious kibbutzim. They moved. It was Bnei Akiva which produced much more than Merkaz Harav. Bnei Akiva was the backbone initially of the settlement movement. So in terms of asset, absolutely. Absolutely. Religious Zionism, and I would say the settlement movement as well, has been a tremendous invigorating force in Israeli society. The danger is I don't know whether to say equally compelling. Sometimes I feel more so, sometimes less so. But the extreme divisive nature of the settlement movement on world Jewry, the devastating impact on Israel's image around the world in the shift from kibbutz to settlement is something that I live with on a regular basis. I speak a lot on campuses in the States. And sometimes I get very angry at the settlers for making my job so much more difficult. I'm angry at that part of the settlement movement, and I think it's a minority, but an important minority in the settlement movement that is determined to hold the rest of Israeli society, in effect, under blackmail, which is to say, under no circumstances, no matter what, will we ever leave. And if you try to create an agreement which will force us to leave, we will try to bring you down. We will bring chaos to Israeli society. And I think that's a threat from a minority, but it's there. I think that what we see with the Hilltop Youth, which is a minority within a minority, nevertheless, the settlement movement has given birth to anti-Zionist anarchists. And that's what the Hilltop Youth are. So I'm afraid. I fear the disappointment of the settlers. And one can feel that there's a sense of if my vision of Israel isn't fulfilled, then Israel is a failure. Israel has betrayed itself. And Yeshayahu Leibovich, who was in many ways a very problematic individual, said something that has haunted me, which is, he said that the day that Israel withdraws from Judea and Samaria, you will see, I think he, you know, he was really a provocateur. I think he said, you'll see mass conversion among the former settlers. Or maybe he said that they'll leave the country. It was something really provocative like that. I don't think that that's what we'll see, but I do think that we would see an insurrection. And the threat of real violence from a significant fringe of that population. The settlement movement allowed this violent fringe to take root. Hebron is the perfect example. The fact that the leaders of Kach, the leaders of the Kahanist movement, were allowed by the Jewish community in Hebron to settle there, with all, it's like really bringing in the pyromaniacs into a volcano. That, to my mind, was a crime. And do Jews have the right to live in Hebron? Not just the right, we have the responsibility to live in Hebron. Whatever happens in terms of sovereignty, that's a different question. But the question, what kind of Jew should be living in Hebron? Should it be the leaders of the Kahanist movement? That's the tragedy. So I fear. Well, I would expand it to say that it's not just a question of religious Zionism. I would speak about Orthodox Judaism generally. I would include the Haredi world in this. The Orthodox community, for me, is the source of our greatest vitality, and it is also the source of our greatest divisions. And the fact that, I think I'm allowed to say this at Pardes, the fact that the state of Israel has entrusted Judaism to one exclusive denomination is, to my mind, an anti-Zionist act. Zionism is the ideology of Jewish peoplehood, and it is about placing the Jewish people above particular halachic considerations. That's one reason why the Haredim were right to oppose Zionism. The religious Zionists understood what this move was. For them, Jewish peoplehood is itself a supreme halachic value. The Haredim have not made that conceptual shift. And so what has happened here in Israel is that Orthodox domination of Judaism is actively alienating large parts of American Jewry. I consider that a crime against the Jewish people and a strategic threat in the long term to the state of Israel. So, is the Orthodox world upholding Judaism? Yes. Is it threatening Judaism or the Jewish people? Yes.
Okay, maybe what we'll do is we'll try and deal with something a little less, high tone. And I think we're going to talk.
Was that provocative?
Just calm, you know. I think we're going to turn to art and music. And in your book, you talk about Avital Geva and his environmental art projects. But you write in really adoring tones about singer and songwriter Meir Ariel. His song from 1967, Yerushalayim Shel Barzel, which was sort of a bitter take on Naomi Shemer's Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. And the amazing ballad Agadat Deshe, which really depicts teenage love and carefree living on the lawn of a kibbutz. And then, of course, some of his protest songs and others, Laila Kasher Aval Kochotenu B'Tzuez, and you depict Meir Ariel as sort of the Israeli Bob Dylan. I know that you've written in the Wall Street Journal, I see from your Facebook posts, your active interest in the centrality of Israeli music to the current narrative here in Israel. And we've spoken actually about a spiritual awakening amongst Israeli singers. And I'd like to maybe to ask you if you can share a little bit about Meir Ariel, because especially this is one of the areas in which us Olim have to do a lot of, some of us have read our history. When it comes to poetry and music and cinema, we don't always have the background, and we need to really play catch up in this area. So if you can share a little more about Meir Ariel and why he's such an important figure for you, and also tell us a little bit about things that you're identifying in Israeli popular music, and why, and how those trends, can teach us things about what's going on in Israel.
That is an easier question. The truth is, when you asked me earlier who my favorite character is, it's really Meir Ariel. And the reason that I don't dare to say that is because I never actually met him. He died in 1999. Tragically, he was 57. He died of a bug bite that could have been treated with antibiotics had it been caught in time. And it's really one of the scandals of Israeli medicine at the time. But I do feel that Meir was one of my closest friends, because I've lived so intimately with him since I started writing this book. Not only did I never meet him, I had never been to a Meir Ariel concert. All those years when he was singing in pubs in Jerusalem to 30 people, and he was among us, and we didn't appreciate him. And now, of course, he's one of the most revered figures in Israeli music. And I think he is the great Israeli composer of this last generation. Naomi Shemer was the great composer of the first generation of statehood. And Meir was the great composer of the post-state era, to my mind. And one of the reasons for that, well, first of all, Meir Ariel, to my mind, never wrote a bad line. It's extraordinary. Bob Dylan wrote many awful lines. He wrote the greatest lines that have been written, but he also wrote some of the worst lines. And now he's putting out albums of Frank Sinatra songs, so really, go figure. But Meir would not have done. Meir would not sing Frank Sinatra. And he literally did not write a bad line. And I've studied, I think, most of his songs. And what makes Meir so extraordinary is, first of all, his language. Nobody writes Hebrew like Meir Ariel. It's a combination of the old kibbutz and a biblical sensibility. And as he became more knowledgeable in Judaism, and he did, he took on Judaism, I'll speak about that in a moment, he began to bring in a Mishnaic Hebrew. And so there are levels of Hebrew. Reading Meir is like a linguistic archaeological tell, and it's just fantastic. There will be doctorates written about Meir Ariel. There will be serious study of Meir's work. In terms of what he represented, Meir was. You had mentioned the words protest songs, and that's I think a common perception of Meir's work. I don't think they're protest songs at all. I think that he's writing from a place of deep sadness. He wrote one song that I would think of as a protest song, which is the most extraordinary to my mind. The most extraordinary. Creation of Hebrew music. It's called Midrash Yonati. And he wrote it just before the First Intifada broke out, in response to the Jewish underground that you had mentioned earlier that had tried to blow up the temple, the Dome of the Rock. And it is a song of rage against the return of what he saw as Second Temple zealotry, and he uses biblical and Mishnaic language to convey his rage. And what's so beautiful about this song is that he's not condemning the right from a left-wing place. He's doing it as an argument within Judaism, and that's what the left, which adopted this song, didn't understand, that this is what Meir was really doing. And so it had this extraordinary force of almost, we spoke earlier about prophecy. I the first time I heard that song, I felt Meir had experienced something or what Rav Tzvi Yehuda had experienced. And there are these moments in the Israeli story that are prophetic. And if I can digress for a moment, I'll just give you another example, which when I came across, I literally had chills. In 1978 or 79, there was a debate in the Knesset about the founding of Gush Katif, the settlement block in Gaza. And Meir Pa'il, who was an old Palmachnik and then became the head of a left-wing party, a very small left-wing party, spoke in the Knesset. And he turns to Sharon, and he says, I weep. He's speaking directly to Sharon, 1979. He says, I weep when you build Katif, and I will weep when you dismantle Katif. And that for me, you know, I mean, there were really moments of prophecy in this story. And so, and it came from all sides. It came from the right, it came from the left at different moments. And so for me, Meir was a prophet of several forces in Israeli society. He was the prophet of the decline of the kibbutz. He saw it way before others did. And he wrote about it as someone who loved the kibbutz. He saw his world beginning to fray, to lose its vitality. And he wrote from a place of deep anguish. One of his greatest songs, which really has become an anthem for young Israelis who never knew Meir, is called Laila Shaket Avar Al Kochotenu B'Suez, a quiet night passed for our forces in Suez. And it was an expression that was taken from Israeli radio in the aftermath of the Yom Kippur War, when there was a war of attrition in the weeks after the war. And so if there was a quiet night, our forces passed the quiet night. And Meir took that as a starting point, and wrote this extraordinary stream of consciousness song about being on guard duty, in Suez City. And it is every soldier who has ever spent a forlorn night on guard duty can understand that song. And so it wasn't a protest song. it's very often seen that way, but it is filled with just the sense of a soldier watching his hours and days and months go by and saying to himself, you know, where am I? What is my life? And it wasn't a protest against the army. It wasn't a protest against the Zionist ethos. It was simply coming from that deep sense of my life is passing. And so Mayer became the kind of the cult hero of disaffected young Israelis in the 70s and the 80s who didn't fully understand him, because Meir was never disaffected. Meir remained a passionate Israeli his entire life, and he never saw his work as being an expression of rejection. He always wrote from within, even, as I mentioned earlier, when he was at his angriest. And Meir was almost never angry, personally and in his music. But that those rare moments where he was coming from within the Israeli ethos, deeply. And the final piece of where I think Meir... Well, let me just say actually one more thing about that, which is that Meir, what makes Meir so precious is that he navigated his generation's transition from a kind of naive Zionism of growing up on the kibbutz and then 67 to the shattering that happened to his generation with the Yom Kippur War. And that shattering was a profound disillusionment, which we're still living with in certain parts of Israeli society to this day. And Meir expressed that shattering, but did so musically and poetically, and I believe also ideologically, by seeing himself in continuity with the Zionist and Israeli story. Okay, now we're in the next phase of this story, which is cynicism, disillusionment, but not throwing away the story itself. And Meir was able to hold the tension between cynicism, and he was very cynical about the kinds of disappointments that his generation felt, especially his generation of kibbutz. And at the same time, never losing his ability to love the story and express his love for the story. So that was Meir. And the final thing about Meir that I think is so extraordinary is you mentioned that Israeli music has taken a spiritual turn, and I think it's not only has it taken a spiritual turn, but the wonderful irony of Israeli music is that Hebrew music in the early years of the state and certainly in the pre-state era was the carrier of the Zionist secular ethos. And that ethos was that we're creating a new Jew here that's more or less cut off from the diaspora, from the last 2,000 years of culture. And you see that sensibility in the early Israeli and Zionist music. That was music that was intended for Israelis. Diaspora Jews had no place in that music. It wasn't meant for diaspora Jews. What's happening today is that Israeli music has become the carrier of the re-Judaization of Israeli culture. The most vital elements within Israeli popular music, think of Ehud Banai, Eviatar Banai, anybody named Banai, Barry Sakharov has just come out with a great album, Likutim, which is full of religious imagery. And this is Barry Sakharov, who was the Israeli Lou Reed, you know, 15 years ago. So really, there's so much that's happening in Israeli music. And the father or grandfather of this phenomenon was Meir Ariel. And if you listen to Meir's music today, especially his later music, it becomes more and more overtly religious. Meir, in his last years, was a fully religious Jew. He used to sit and write in tefillin. He would spend the whole morning writing in tefillin. And his widow, Tirza, who was fantastic and really, really opened up in extraordinary ways to me. And she told me the story of Meir was sitting in tefillin one morning, as he was every morning, writing music. And a friend calls up and asks Tirza, can I speak to Meir? And Tirza says, I can't, he's busy swaying. So Meir is, you know, in the same way that Kfar Etzion is the missing link, you know, between the kibbutz movement and the settlement movement, Meir is the missing link between the Hebrew music, the Zionist music that he grew up with, embodied, and then played with, and took to its next stage, and this new re-Judaization. One of Meir's greatest songs was found after his death by his friend Shalom Chanoch, the musician. And Shalom Chanoch, for those of you who know, I think Shalom Chanoch may be the greatest rocker in Israeli, him and Barry Sakharov are really the two great rockers. And the fact that Meir Ariel and Shalom Chanoch grew up in the same Beit Yeladim, on a forlorn little kibbutz, mishmarot, of maybe 120 people. For me, that's one of the classical proofs of the existence of God. and Shalom found this cassette. Remember cassettes? He found a cassette in Meir's drawer after he died. And on this cassette are songs that Meir was just playing, sitting in his room, I guess, in tefillin, and playing on the guitar. And he recorded it on a simple cassette. And one of those songs was Modeh Ani. And Shalom produced an album called Modeh Ani posthumously for Meir. And Modeh Ani, for those of you who don't know it, you must know it. Go listen and see what Meir does with a modern Israeli sensibility to a classical Jewish prayer, that meeting point of an Israeli of a modern sensibility. And Meir was writing Mat Piyut. He was writing contemporary prayer when he died. In fact, there's another song which he did not record. He wrote the words to, and those words were put to music by one of Meir's son's friends, a musician. And it is pure devotional music. And so you see the evolution of Meir from the wise guy bohemian of Israeli music to the forerunner, the prophet of this transformation of Israeli music.
Wow. Okay. Well, what I'm going to do, since I've been asking so many questions, is I'm going to give an opportunity for one or two questions from the audience. If anybody would like to ask a question, the gentleman over there.
What is your opinion on the whole issue of a Jewish nation, or as I would refer to Jewish nation? From your book, do you see a solution to our life? And how do we change? I agree with your point that we occupy people, not land. But how do we change the narrative in the sense that, in my view, the world has been telling Jews where to live for the last 3,000 years, and they don't differentiate between the Jewish quarter and Hari Hebron, and to the point where Jerusalem is not a capital and Jerusalem can't be put on a pedestal.
So what's the question then of that last point? How do we change the narrative? In terms of the Temple Mount, I unfortunately, and I say that really with a great deal of pain, the status quo, I think, is the only non-solution solution. There is no solution. And thank God we have a convergence of secular political wisdom with mainstream religious restrictions, which doesn't apply now, or growing numbers of people within the religious Zionist community are revolting against those restrictions. And I think the results are potentially, God forbid, catastrophic. And I think we need to really speak with in two voices. I think we need to tell the international community not to take that status quo for granted, which it does. We never get credit for the fact that we have effectively relinquished our right to pray at our holiest place. No nation, religion, homeland has ever done that before. And I think it's outrageous that that the status quo is taken for granted as natural and inevitable. It is neither. But at the same time, we need to speak internally to ourselves and to say that to tell those who are for totally understandable reasons feel this profound frustration that here we are finally back and we can't exercise our right to prayer. It is an absurdity, but the conversation we need to have with ourselves is that that is an essential absurdity to preserve. The question of the narrative, you know, it's gone so far that that I don't know how really to tell that story. I'll give you an example of the difficulty of telling our narrative. Like Dreamers was not translated into any European languages. And my agent told me that Europeans are not interested in a 600-page book about settlers that treats them as legitimate characters in a story. And so settlers, and we don't fully realize this, settlers have become demonic figures in the world's imagination. And we are this is the new evil of this generation. And so the what we're up against goes so much deeper than questions of settlements. What we're facing is a rejection of our indigenousness, which, to my mind, what makes this so outrageous is that the more indigenous we become, the more we succeed in re-indigenizing ourselves here by producing one generation after another of native Israelis, the more our indigenousness is being called into question. It was, to my mind, until 1948, it was a fair argument over Zionism. The Jewish world was divided over Zionism until the Shoah, deeply divided. It was a fair argument. No people had ever done this before, coming back after 2,000 years. It really is, on the face of it, ludicrous. It was a fair argument. As soon as we came back and established ourselves, the debate over Zionism is, to my mind, a debate over the right of the Jewish people to exist. And we are losing that debate. And we're losing it for all kinds of reasons. And I'll really try not to go on about this, but just one point is that we are still telling essentially a Holocaust and Ashkenazi story about Israel. And that narrative, which worked for the first generation and the second generation of Israel, is now working actively against us because it reinforces the anti-Zionist narrative, which depicts Israel as a white European colonialist implant. And when we talk about Holocaust, what we're saying is what Obama said in Cairo, which is the only justification for our existence here is because we suffered. And then the obvious Palestinian response is, well, why should we pay for what the Europeans did to you? That's what Ahmadinejad said. And the story that we need to start telling is a much deeper story. We need to tell the 4,000-year story. We need to tell the story of a majority of Israeli Jews who come from the Middle East, who have family origins in the Jewish communities that were destroyed in the Middle East. And we haven't told that story. And so the Zionist story that we need to tell, obviously, we need to tell a whole story. And that story is the experience of the Jewish people in the 20th century, both in Europe, but also with increasing urgency, the story we need to tell is of the Jews of the Middle East.
Okay. Over here.
Hi, my name is Dan. I'm one of the Pardes students. I was curious before when you were talking about the conceptual shift, that the Zionism is an ideology of Jewish peoplehood, and that the people are a priority over the halakha is not a conceptual shift that the Yehuda Din have made yet. And so I think telling that story of the past 4,000 years is really important facing the rest of the world, the outer world. But as for the internal world, where everyone in the room is already Jewish, what is it that we do already have in common? What are the key terms of that shared language that can allow us to walk together from the Haredim side of the spectrum and the opposite side of that spectrum, whether it's the Knesset up in Gamsucker or the Knesset around the corner for daily davening?
It's a really good question. What unites the whole Jewish people, from the Haredim to how far do you want to go with this? To as far as you can go. And what are the common elements of peoplehood that would unite us? The crisis of Jewish life today is that we don't have an answer for that question. In the past, the answer was a shared fate, if not a shared destiny. Rav Soloveitchik made a distinction. He said that there's the commonality of destiny, and there's the commonality of fate. And he said if all Jews don't, in today's world, share a same sense of common destiny, we at least share a same sense of common fate. Where that has broken down today is that we increasingly blame each other for jeopardizing our well-being, our survival. So the left sees the settlement movement as an existential threat to Israel, demographically and all kinds of other ways. The right sees the left as an existential threat, imposing a delusional peace which will weaken us and we won't have our ability to defend ourselves. And as a centrist, I agree with both of them. In the Haredi world, you hear these expressions of rage against Reform Judaism coming from Haredi leaders. They're worse than the Nazis. I mean, this kind, literally that, worse than the Nazis. You say, where does this come from? And I think it's coming from that same place of the right and the left seeing the other as an existential threat. Haredim worry that if we lose the plot as they understand it, then God will throw us out of here. And so Tel Aviv is an existential threat to Israel. Hedonism, if one wants to have a simplistic notion of Tel Aviv, the Haredi idea of Tel Aviv, is an existential threat to our survival here. And the moment that groups of Jews see the main enemy as other groups of Jews, then you lose the most basic commonality of fate. Because the threats, the physical threats that we face are coming from within. They're being provoked by the enemy within. And that's the beginning of the end of a common Jewish people. And that's where we are now. And the work that we need to do, and this is a work for the next generation, and we haven't begun to do this work conceptually, intellectually, spiritually, is to ask ourselves that question that you just asked. What is the shared basis? Is there a shared basis anymore? I believe that there has to be, otherwise we really, God forbid, will lose the thread of Jewish continuity. But I can't pull out easy answers anymore, precisely because groups of Jews now perceive each other as the primary threat. So even the commonality of fate is being taken away from us.
Well, you know what happens when Jews have to discuss the fact that the Jewish people is reaching a point where it's, you know, causing its own demise. They just daven Maariv. That's what they do.
According to which version?
We're going to try and include everybody here. Our time is coming to an end. I just want to say this has been incredibly informative, enlightening, and inspirational.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Toda rabba.
For those of you who have had Light Dreamers on their shelf, I think you're probably going to go home tonight and start reading it. For those of you who haven't bought the book, I think it's on sale outside. I'd like to thank everybody for joining us tonight, and thank you Yossi Klein Halevi for an amazing evening. Thank you.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.